Ink Stud, CITR 101.9 FM. I'm sitting here in a, I don't know how to describe this lounge. With
it's a loungy lounge.
It's got neo-retro, I don't know.
It's Granville Island.
It's Granville. There's a little stone carving, so you know it's Vancouver. There's some stone carving.
There we go. I'm sitting here with Mariko Tamaki.
No.
Did I get the pronounce right?
Yeah, you did great.
Awesome. And, as always, the ever humble Steve Rolston.
Here.
Nice to have you here, Steve.
Present.
Present. I'm here.
Nay.
Wee.
And, Mariko, you're in town for the Vancouver Writers Festival.
Yes.
Hanging out with prestigious folks.
Yeah.
Are you hanging out with any writers?
The only writer that I've gotten to hang out with so far is, or significantly, is Sean Tan, who's a really amazing...
He is so nice!
He's really sweet and has this awesome Australian accent, and I just sort of glanced at his book right before we did our panel together and instantly fell in love with it, and then kind of like a sea urchin, I've been kind of clinging to him ever since. I just think it's amazing, so...
His accent is like a gentle Australian, yeah. It's like the waves over the coal or over the shore.
It's like if Disney ever did an animated film about Australia, I would nominate him to play like the gentle kangaroo or something like that. Like it's just so, and his work is amazing. So I've been reading it since I got here. It's been a really amazing kind of surprise.
And so you did a couple of you did a panel yesterday with them, and then doing another one tomorrow.
I did a panel called Show to Tell, which was sort of about graphic novelists and the sort of transition from the page to the or some from word to picture, I guess. And then today I went to a high school.
What high school?
King George. King George Secondary.
Maybe.
It's on Barnaby Street. Burnaby Street? On Burnaby Street.
Oh, is it down? Oh, yeah. It's downtown.
So I went there with some grade 12s who were sufficiently cynical, which was really cool. And then tomorrow I'm doing a panel called The Outsiders, which is about writing about the outsider experience of being a teenager.
Which is the framework of both here.
It's kind of my thing right now. It's like, I don't know.
You're
what to
the
tell
bitter
you.
Teenager.
It's kind of I know my. Actually, I was talking to my mom recently, and she said, "You know, lots of really interesting stuff happened to you after you went to high school." I was like, "What's your point?" And she was like, "I'm just saying, it would be interesting if you wrote about something other than high school." It's not like I think that life stops after you know grade 13. It's just always been. Sort of an area of life that I'm interested in.
And so. For those that don't know, grade 13 is like the equivalent of first year of...
Back in my day, it was grade 13. Now it'd be grade 12.
Yeah, they got rid of grade 13.
Rid of us.
Well, the thing is, it was grade 13, though, because you were that much older than the folks in grade 12. Like, it wasn't like you were the equivalent to 12 here. It was an extra year.
Except that I was a year younger, because I'm born in December, so I was always the youngest person... In my grade.
You could just say it's because you're a smarty pants.
I was so smart.
Nothing to do with when you're born.
No, nothing. It's just my genius.
Now, your two books are Amico Superstar with Mr. Steve Rolston.
Sweet.
Still here.
Still here.
And the one you did with your cousin, Jillian Tamaki, Skim.
Yes.
And beside that, you also write... Now, I was reading, is it nonfiction type stuff and
nonfiction.
Poetry?
I never wrote poetry.
No.
I've never written poetry.
Oh, okay. I thought I read
just not something I got into. Well, I mean, I may have, as a young lesbian, tried to pen some poetry and, you know, for social reasons, but I've never had any poetry published. So mostly, before I got into comic books, what I was sort of better known for, I guess, was writing sort of creative nonfiction, sort of short essay type stuff. A lot of the stuff I wrote was kind of about sort of cultural, social issues and about sort of race and sexuality, kind of stuff like that. So the first book I ever published was a novel, so I've kind of done everything.
How old are you?
I'm 32. Yeah.
You got a lot accomplished.
I know, I'm like busy for 32, I guess. But, you know, I mean, at the same time, I think that I've always been surrounded by opportunity. Like, I'm really fortunate to have always had some link to opportunity. So, I have been in touch with publishers. I've had offers to do things, and I've never said no to an offer to do anything, pretty much. So that's why I think I've gotten so much out there.
Well, let's start out by chatting a bit about Skim.
Oui.
Oh, this French. I'm
I know.
Confused.
What's just a one word of French?
Ça va?
Ça va.
Pas mal. That's the extent of my French. What was the impetus
to write a book like Skim?
Yeah, because it's a new comic, or a new vocation.
Well, it was an opportunity. I was there's a magazine, or used to be a literary magazine in Toronto called Kiss Machine, which is edited and published by this woman Emily Polweary. And I was on tour with Emily Polweary on this thing called the Perpetual Motion Tour, which is essentially a very low budget, four artists in a car drive from Toronto to Michigan and stop, and each it's the city a night, stop and do a performance a night. So it's hell. And I was in the car with this woman, and we were talking about where our writing was at, and she said that Kiss Machine was going to put out a series of comics by first-time comic writers. And you could pair yourself, it was pairing illustrators who had never done comics with writers who had never done comics.
Oh, wow.
And I was basically like, I'll do a comic. Can I do a comic?
I'll do it.
Bring it. Let's do it. And she was like, who would you have illustrated? And I knew that my cousin, Jillian, was an illustrator. I had sort of gotten out of art school a couple years earlier, and I'd had used her art for a cover of a book before. She'd given me a piece of art for a cover of a book before. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting thing to do. And I thought, you know, I knew I wanted to write about a girl who was Japanese Canadian. I wanted to have that sort of take on the sort of, not do the sort of basic Archie and Veronica type faces. Yeah. And I knew that she had a style that would fit really well with that. And it was just really amazing coincidence. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time and like snatch up the opportunity, like, I'll do it.
All the pieces just lined up together.
Yeah, I'll do it. My cousin will do it. It'll be awesome. Let me do it. And she was like, what would you write a book about? And it just was this thing I had thought of for a long time, of writing this, like, gothic Lolita story. And that sounds really good, I guess. And she was like, ooh, that sounds good. And I was like, I know. I think it'll be great. Let's do that. I think we should do it. So I just found the place.
But it's definitely not a gothic Lolita story.
It's not. And the problem is, I mean, as with any writer, you have these sort of lofty aspirations to do something. And then you actually sit down and start writing it. And then the character, like when I sort of imagined this romance between this girl and this teacher, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, there's no way that I can have this, in a real world, have this girl get together with this teacher and have it be like, oh, this is awesome. Let's get a house together. You know, let's go to Paris. You know, this is, you know, it just wouldn't work out that way. I was like, logically, it just could not happen. And once I started writing the characters, I was like, life is way too complex. Like, people don't fall in love for the first time and have it just be like, you know, oh, this is perfect. I never knew you were around. Yay! Like, especially when you're a teenager.
High five!
So, yeah, yay! So it turned into something more complicated because just as I was writing it, it was like, oh, this is, I can't do this. Damn, you know? I wanted it, I mean, you know, as someone who kind of had this idea in the beginning, I would have loved to have written that story, but it just was not there.
You gotta go where the story takes you.
You gotta go where the story takes you. Very Margaret Lawrence-y, like, I heard the voices and that's what they said. But I think that it's true. And I think that it, like, all these other things came out of going where the characters took me, so I'm really happy with that.
Jaime Hernandez, he is very, like, I interviewed him a long time ago, and he's telling me how his characters, they all drive themselves.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't do the story. Like, it's the story that comes out.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, I tend to think that I'm more of a leader than a follower with my characters. But I think that you never know where a story's going to go until you get into it. I mean, because as a writer, I think a lot of the times you sort of write yourself into something and then you have to write yourself out. So I kind of wrote myself into this romance, and then as I was writing myself out, I was like, oh, this is not going to work. Oh, okay, well, what is going to work? And I think it was good for me because it made me sort of think about all the things that would come into play in those kind of situations. Like when you fall in love in high school, what else is going on? And there's a million things going on, so.
It's, yeah, the story's not necessarily about love, but it seems it's about high school.
It really is about, it's kind of a little petri dish, I think, about high school life. And I tried not to do too much of a, you know, this is the popular, I mean, I think write about outsiders, like in terms of people who are on the fringe, but I don't think it plays out the way that the truth in high school is that your best friend one month is not going to be your best friend the next month, and mm-hmm. so there's all this kind of mingling that happens, and I'm kind of glad that that got its way into the book as well.
The subgroup interspersing.
Yeah, because every once in a while, the geek, you need to have the geek come over and fix your computer, or, you know, you'll be in a you know, you have to do a square dance project or something, and then there's four of you instead of two. So, you know, it happens all the time. Where there was square dancing and whatnot. But it just works out that way. And, you know, cliques are complicated because it works out that way.
Were you a young goth?
I was a wee goth, but, I mean, I've often said, like, I think the goths, the way they get portrayed, is this very sort of put-together, polished look of, like, black lipstick, you know, black hair, little, like, you know, old-timey,
like
Bo Peepy outfits.
And out of a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, like, super together, and my version of goth was, like, just kind of depressed-looking, and Nine Inch Nails t-shirt, and trying to carry black jeans, black shoes, but, you know, it was much more sort of stage manager aesthetic than it was, like, and it was like a kind of sexy goth aesthetic. So
I hear there's a big junior stage manager scene in some high schools.
Yeah, I think that, and really the cool people to know in high school are the stage managers, are the theater people who are not on stage. Yeah.
I hung out when I was in my brief tenure in high school, was hanging out in the auditorium at Sir Charles Tupper. It's a classy school.
Yeah. Sir Charles.
Yeah. Sir Charles Tupper. It's probably the most ghetto school in Vancouver.
Oh, really?
God bless.
I hung out in the anti-ghetto. See, I hung out, like, my high school was, like, the sort of super prim private school, and we used to go in the ravine and wait by the fence for the people from the not-so-nice high school to be smoking, and then we would try to get them to feed us cigarettes through the fence.
No, you're from Toronto.
I am
high
from
school
Toronto.
I went to a high school in Toronto for about 3 months at one point, and it's crazy how many, like, everyone there, it seems like they're from a private school.
Yeah, there's a lot. A lot of them. A lot of private schools. And
it
it's a whole
weird.
Other strange culture of, I mean, because you're in this, I mean, you have this vague sense when you're there that you're in this weird kind of old-timey place, you know? You're like, this is weird, we're all wearing uniforms, like, do people still do this? Why are we doing this? Like, going to prayers every morning, you're like, this is kind of creepy. Nobody else has to do this. So you get this weird sense that you're in this kind of other section of people.
It's kind of a weird, like, almost cultural segregation that you're put into,
mm-hmm.
where it's a different world.
It is a different world. Oh, and I mean, you're marked, right? Like, it's a different world, and there's no denying it. Like, when you go to the mall, and you're in green tights and a green kilt and a, you know, white shirt and tie, it's not like you can be like, look, I'm just like everybody else. It's like, no, you're not. You're in a tie. No one else is in a tie. You're in a tie. You're, you know, what's going on? And you get shunned a little bit. And then
you get the creepy old guys.
And then you get the creepy old guys. I know. I'm all about the creepy old guys. That's why I wrote Amico Superstar. The other side of things, the creepy old guys.
Stop. We'll be right back.
Is that something important between the two books, is to have them being different characters in that way, like, I guess, the sexuality aspect of the two characters?
I think I tend to write about people who are, both books have characters who are ultimately fairly shy and low-key people, but they're sort of silent but deadly, you know? It's like they're quiet people, but quiet people have lots of things to say and sort of observations about society. And I was a quiet kid, and I think I go for quiet characters because I tend to think that I had some insight. Even though I was quiet, I had some stuff going on back then, so... and I try to, I really try to write about, you know, people who are alone, but try to write them into a community somehow, like trying to see the big picture of, like, because most teenagers feel alone, and it's important to see, I think, that you are in some way or another always either right next to or surrounded by, like, a whole other, you know, school of fish.
Who all have their own issues going on.
Exactly. We're all freaking out, and, I mean, and Amico Superstar is about this, the idea that, you know, you think that your life is maybe not so hot and, you know, other people may look glamorous, but even glamorous people have stuff going on, so.
How, between the two books, has your process changed as far as approaching comics?
Drastically. I mean, Skim, I wrote Skim like a play. I wrote Skim, it was a very minimalist script, that's the word I'm looking for. Skim and script, that's messed up there. So what I sent to Jillian was basically like a series of scenes. So I wrote it like a play, and I gave her the narration, and I gave her the dialogue, and I would sort of say, like, this is what happens. I would roughly be like, oh, they're at school, or oh, they're outside of school, and or it would be evident from the narration what was happening, but I didn't tell her, like, panel one, I didn't tell her how much space to take. I didn't tell her what visuals to go that she would, you know, that I wanted included. Like, nothing. We had a couple conversations during her process. So I finished the script in its entirety and sent it to her complete, and she took that script and then started making thumbs. But I didn't even really. She sort of sent me when she completed for the novel. When she completed the whole thing, she sort of sent me to look at, and I really had nothing to say. I was like, awesome.
And it works quite to her skills. Like, it doesn't read. What happens, a lot of people are new to comics as illustrators. It reads like a talking head.
Oh, yeah?
Like, you read something and it's, you know, there's a little head. But it's very fluid, I guess.
Yeah.
It's,
I think, and because she's an illustrator by trade, like, she has this amazing sense of creating sort of emotion and sort of, like, creating sort of feeling atmospheres. Like, the stuff that she does as an illustrator is really beautiful, and I think what she was able to do was kind of combine that sort of big picture, like the sort of using the whole page as a canvas, with also sort of pulling off into panels when stuff was happening or when dialogue was going on. So, I mean, it's funny because now, when I work for DC, I got all these rules, like, don't put any more than five lines of dialogue or five lines of text per panel. And I know there are places where Jillian was like, what the hell? Like, how am I going to get all this in here? And I'm reading it like, ooh, that's a lot. Like, there are places where I gave characters, like, a monologue. And there's actually one scene in the book where you can see there's, like, a huge, you know, balloon with, like,
and
text.
She draws, like, a little head in the corner.
Well, and she did, I mean, she did all the text, too. Like, she did all the lettering herself. It's all done by hand. And so we would have conversations where she'd be like, I can't even talk to you right now. And I'd just be like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that this is how this is going to play out. Like, it's a huge amount of work on her part. And I think that it was almost like it was a task for me, and then it was a huge task for her. And, like, you know, it was the first time I appreciated the sort of illustrative part of it, because I wrote Skim in, like, a period of 4 months or something like that. And then Jillian had, like, a year and a half to try to put this whole thing together, and it was a massive project. Like, it's like watching a building go up, you know? It was really intense.
Comics are one of the most labor-intensive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think, something that doesn't get appreciated very much, like, but, I mean, and for me it was interesting because I sort of saw her doing stuff, but I couldn't even put, like, I didn't even really know the word panels until she was talking about it, and I was like, oh, they're called panels! I did not know that. Like, I didn't know anything. And then when I went to DC...
And this boxy thing
here with the square, with the corners. What is this thing here?
Do you know gutters yet?
I know gutters because she kept talking about gutters. She would talk about... Like, she would... When we would get... When Skim was first published by Kiss Machine, we were talking about the gutter. And I had some, I finally kind of grasped from many conversations. I was like, oh, the gutter, oh, the thing besides boxes. Is that the gutter? What are we talking about here? And I would kind of like wait for her to point at something and be like, oh, okay, awesome. But I mean, I didn't know any of the lingo until with DC Comics. When working with Shelley Bond, she was sort of like, okay, well, send me sort of a breakdown, and then you can start writing the whole thing. And I was like, how exactly do you want me to do that? Like, do you want me to do what I did last time? And I explained to her what that was, and she was like, no, can't do that. Like, that's not going to work.
Are you happy about that, Steve?
That I didn't just send you narration and dialogue?
I mean, I could have made it work. But
yeah. I mean, I think it's workable. I mean, the thing is, though, I think for a company like DC, they want to see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And like Groundwood gave us almost no, there was a very little presence of them in our creative process. I wrote it, Jillian sort of did the, I think she was at pencils and sort of showed them what she was doing, and they were never like, oh, I don't know. Like, they didn't need to see it. They saw the finals and there was a couple comments, but they were really minute. And DC wants to see everything, and they have like a real sense of like, okay, what's happening here? This is how exactly how this is going to get laid out. And they have preferences, whereas
yep.
Groundwood had none.
They have a structure.
They have a structure. They have to, and what they did
the
was...
The DC style, too.
Yeah, and so actually I got some pages from, some scripts from Fables. So I got to look at those, and I was like, I have no idea. I like, people would say things like, you know, ECU and MCU, and I was like, I don't.
I don't even know what that is.
Extreme close-up, medium close-up.
Like,
you
know,
take my comic book course. I go over all this stuff.
Steve Rolston does a comic book course. You can find out about it at steverolston.com.
There you go. So, I mean, I didn't take your course either. I probably would have helped, but I just had to sort of, like, from scratch, sit down and figure out, you know, how to say what I needed to say, and then to figure out exactly, like, to tell someone what you wanted a page to look like exactly was daunting.
Since doing Skim and kind of jumping into the comics world head first.
Elbow first.
Elbow. Bam! That's the Toronto hockey style.
Yeah.
What have you learned and what's really like kind of shaped as far as comic influences since then?
I think before I went into comics, I was a really big fan of the metaphor. And I think that that was my favorite way to play with sort of visuals, was to sort of twist, sort of, like, twist what you'd normally sort of expect a comparison to be and sort of play with, like, different possibilities with that. And I think that especially since doing, seeing what happened with Skim, and since working on Miko Superstar, I think visually a little bit more. Like, I can see things on a page, and, like, I really enjoyed the process of seeing how things would be laid out on a page and imagining how things would be laid out on a page. And, I mean, it just is a whole different approach to... it's a whole different approach to telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to paying attention to what details you want people to... Like, thinking about what details you want people to pay attention to as, like, an actual visual thing rather than just, you know... like the sort of focal point of a story or whatever. It's just really...
The layers.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And also, like, I mean, truthfully, I was not a huge comic book fan before I started writing Skim, just because I didn't know. Like, I just came from a really literary place. So I had read, you know, sort of Archie and Jughead and stuff like that in my past, and I'd read, like, a couple superhero comics, but very few. And then I had been given Persepolis, so I had read that. But now, like, I love it. Like, I love going to conventions.
You
and
just
I'm
went to SPX, right?
I just went to SPX.
Which is, like, the holy land of conventions.
It was nuts. It was, first of all, it was crazy, because people were walking around. Someone had been passing out felt bunny hats. So there were all these people in felt bunny hats, which I kept telling my cousin. I was like, I'm freaking out. They're, like, everywhere. These bunny creatures. Totally making me mental.
I'm glad they're not furries. They don't just get really creepy.
Oh, it was like that. It was just a bit odd. It was like Mexican masks, but they were bunnies. It was just weird. But you know, I'm so happy to have been introduced to people like Brian Lee O'Malley and like Hope Larson, and even like at the last one, I picked up Jason Lutz, book, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, now I'm like a comics fiend. Like, I love them, so that's really great, I think.
Lutz is pretty awesome.
Lutz is amazing. The way Lutz draws, I got the Jar of Fools, and the way he draws dialogue is just, like, the sort of pauses he takes and stuff like that. I love it. It just was, like, captivating to me. It was great.
Well, it's a good time to get into him, because he's actually putting out stuff again, so.
Yeah. Yay! I know, it's just, it's cool.
Now, was Emiko the next step you had in mind, or after Skim?
I didn't have anything in mind, and I really had sort of, I mean, I guess it probably, if DC hadn't come, if Shelley Bond hadn't come along and said, like, do you want to do this again? I don't know how I would have, I wouldn't even know how to pursue it. So I think it was sort of an opportunity to pursue it that I didn't necessarily have sort of planted in my brain, but I'm really glad it came along to sort of try something new. So yeah, I mean, now that's my goal, is to do something like that again.
But a slow glowing dream that your fear seems to hide deep inside your mind. All alone I have cried, silent tears full of pride, in a world made of steel. Believe it.
did you get connected with Quiet Man?
With Mr. Steve? Shelly set us up, man. Shelly
did a good job there.
Shelly did a good job. She gave me four websites to look at. And, you know, you're shopping. Who will I be paired with?
Who can
will
I
be
deal
Robin
with?
To my Batman? You know, you're kind of like, interesting. And Steve had a drawing on his website that was of, I think it was maybe it's you, next to this giant building.
Okay, yeah.
There's like this big brick building. And it was almost like I could picture, as soon as I saw that image, I could picture, because I wanted... Amico Superstar takes place, a lot of it takes place in this kind of rundown factory, this kind of modern day Warhol cabaret factory space. And I really wanted a lot of drawings of this kind of building, this kind of rundown, kind of industrial, kind of crumbly type atmosphere. And as soon as I saw that picture, I was like, that's it. I was like, I want this guy. What's this guy's name? Steve. I want Steve.
Well, that picture's gotten me some good mileage.
Yeah.
That picture was from. A little story I did for an anthology that Scott Morse was putting together, like, years ago.
Yeah.
And the anthology never happened.
Yeah.
But because I had that picture on my, that page on my website, that's how I got the Queen and Country job.
Yeah.
That started my whole career.
Really?
There you go. Yeah. It's really,
I think
just
you
gotta
do more brick buildings, young
man.
Yeah,
you gotta draw some brick buildings. Well, and I mean,
definitely keeping that page on my website.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, it's funny because some of my favorite images from Amico Superstar are, like I would send, I was when we were at the show to tell thing yesterday, I was talking about how it's a lot of performance art type images, and so I would send Steve a thing that would say like, she has wings that are made of chainmail. Go,
that was an interesting.
And it was just like, you know, I could just imagine this kind of quiet fury happening in BC, like, what the hell is she talking about? Wait, the channel doesn't even exist. Like, what the hell?
Just the sound of a pencil breaking.
Yeah, I know. I didn't even have like an image going. Like, I just thought it would be really cool to see what that would look like. So I didn't even have like something to go on. And it looks great. Like, the book is full of all these wicked costumes. So,
now, Steve, how do you feel about being Robin to Batman?
Batman.
Yeah. I just like to make things pretty.
Make it pretty.
Just make it a pretty comic.
Yeah. I think it would have been good to be a fly on the wall because we would have these telephone conferences with Shelley and myself and Steve. And Shelley and I would have been talking for 10 minutes prior to calling Steve about outfits and costumes and hair. And then we call Steve who... Shelley always imagines that when we call Steve that he's sleeping because he's in BC and he's an artist. Yeah.
So they call me at noon BC time. Sometimes, yes, I just woken up. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
But there are, he's like, he'll be sleeping. I'm like, I hope not. It's like 2 over there.
And of course, they're already wired.
Yeah,
giggling and chatting for 10 minutes.
So there's like these conversations where we're like, oh my God, okay, we really want them to be mod. Like, we really want these awesome 60s mod dresses. And, you know, I can just hear on the other end Steve like, huh? Okay. No, okay, sure.
Yeah, okay.
All right,
I
sure.
can do that. Cool.
Okay.
Sure.
We're right. Like, yay, dresses!
He's not a complicated man.
No.
He knows what he can do.
Well, and he's got a fabulous sense of fashion, because if you look at Amico Superstar, there's all these wicked hairstyles and stuff like that. I don't know if they're the hairstyles of Steve's future, but, you know, there's some nice, there's some good hair in here.
Yeah, I got to, you know, let my inner fashion designer come out a bit.
I know, you got some people comb front, and... Some people are a little bit more spiky, and there's some nice little accessories going on. It's pretty cool, I think.
Now, Steve, the style you use in Superstar, it's a little more subdued than your other stuff. Is that a good way of putting it?
Subdued, eh?
I mean that in a complimentary way, as in, like, just focusing, I guess, on the story. I'm not sure what the... The words I'm trying to come out of my mouth, but
yeah, I don't know what you're trying to say either. But I think this is my most natural style.
Yeah,
gets a little bit cartoonier than some of the other projects I've done. You know, keeping this simple line work, which is really, you know, that's actually more my kind of natural way of drawing.
Well, as I've said many times, Steve is one of the cleanest folks. His original pages are just
spotless. It's amazing.
Yeah, that crisp, clean line.
I love
just
it,
can't
though.
Turn it in.
I mean, it's funny because sometimes when I get you get the pencils and some cell phone guy.
Oh, he's
cell phone guy.
He's got a gold chain.
I'll change it. Oh, that's not a good look. That's unfortunate.
The one thing he's missing is a mullet.
Yeah, that's too bad. I like my gold chains big and flat and against the chest, just so we're all clear on that. But the pencils were so I was obsessed with the set of. It didn't look like it had been drawn by a human, which is maybe why people think that you do everything on computer. Like, they just are so neat looking. It's unbelievable.
I'm just a robot.
You're a robot. We were talking today about how people think that illustrators can just type in like circus and all these images of clowns and whatever come out like digitized already, perfect. Ping.
Yeah. Would you say Control Alt Monkey?
Yeah. Control Alt Monkey.
Want more
monkeys?
Just press Control Alt Monkey.
Monkey. Just like pop, pop, pop. Like, you know, on CSI when they're typing on the computer and they're like, I'm just gonna match this fingerprint. With
bringing
other
this other
keyboard. I know, it's ridiculous. It's like the same vision, like the sort of CSI approach to comic drawing.
See, I wear out the clean line button on my computer.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the little tiny eraser, the eraser cursor, like getting all the lines nice.
You actually do a fair amount of research when it comes to your stuff, because, I mean, I've gone to bookstores with you and so on, scouring things just for patterns.
Yeah, I spend way too much time online searching for visual reference, but I think it pays off.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with stuff like the crowd scenes and all the costumes in Amigo Superstar, if I just, you know, try to pull all of that out of my butt, it wouldn't be as cool or as, the, you know, diverse or whatever. So,
tell me about the mod flair.
The mod flair?
You're talking about the mod style, the mod dress.
The mod. Well, it's really... I mean, I think that if you are going to draw sort of teenagers today, it's important to kind of... I mean, because once you get to 16, like, you can hit your retro... You've sort of looked back, and you've sort of find your thing. So you either look back and decide you want to take up a hippie style, or you sort of look forward and decide you want to look like a robot or what have you. But I really wanted this book to be inspired by that kind of Andy Warhol, kind of 60s pop arty type look, so... And the idea is that this girl has access to those kind of clothes, like actual retro clothes.
Her grandma's incredible.
Her grandma's unbelievably pristine, you know, mod dresses. And also I like the idea that kind of outfit would come from, you know, that you would be related to someone who would wear that kind of outfit, I think is pretty cool. I was into that. I dug that idea. So.
Yeah, there's a nice lineage with her and her grandma.
Yeah. Well, that's like a real, I think that's... One of the really amazing things about the Minx line is that there was a concerted effort to make sure that these were stories that had like a real sort of human sort of family element to them. Not like, oh, families are perfect and, oh, it's like, oh, Roseanne, we're all sort of sitting around the dinner table, what have you. But like that there was, I think that sometimes when you see teenagers in sort of the sort of context of television or whatever, they're completely on their own. Like, they have their cars, they've got their credit cards, parents are nowhere to be seen, like, you know, everyone's
like Gossip Girl.
Yeah, exactly, Gossip Girl. They're like, champagne parties, where's my dad? Nowhere, you know, and you're just like, how is that possible? And
I wish my teens were that exciting.
Oh, I know. There's no champagne parties in any book I've ever written, because I don't even know. I mean, I went to a private school and nobody I knew was having champagne parties. So, but I like the idea of that sort of these kind of retro teens mixed up with, like, there's kids who dress as clowns and there's kids who dress as, like, you know, Rocky Horror type things. So there's all different kinds of kids together in this book.
So what was your interest in the quote-unquote freak aesthetic?
What my interest is? I mean, I just think that it's far more interesting. Like,
the whole performance part.
Performance art of it. Well, I mean, I think that there is a sense that being a superstar involves this kind of connecting up with a sort of larger... institution, like, you know, you're a superstar if you go to Hollywood and someone decides to cast you in, you know, their movie or whatever. And my experience with that kind of sort of performance stardom type thing, it's very local. Like, I started off in Montreal at, you know, kind of underground sort of open mic stages type thing, and that was my first sort of brush with fame, I guess you could call it. And I think that was a huge part of becoming an artist for me, was sort of getting on stage and kind of hanging out with other artisty freak type people. Like, that was what pulled me away from being a private school girl and pulled me towards something else. So I really liked that idea. And I also liked, I mean, there was a couple sort of elements to that scene which I always thought would be really interesting to look at, like the fact that there's this weird kind of age gap that happens. Like, you have these kind of kids who are coming in, who are in their, you know, 16, 17 years old. And then there's people like the curator in the book who are these, like, 40-year-old guys. And real I used creeps. To always kind of go into these to these spaces and be like, why is that guy here? Like, yeah. What else does he have to do? Why is he in charge? You know, like, you just sort of be like, what do you do? Like, that we suddenly think you're such an authority on, like, you know, what it means to be cool. You're 40 and you're here. Like, I don't understand this. So I kind of wanted to put my little, that sort of element of it in there. Zing him.
The stamp of authoritarian,
you know, it
disrepute.
It never made sense to me. Like, in the goth scenes, you'd always have, like, these, like, little, like, role-playing elves who were, like, 16 years old. And then the Archimedes, like, the old wizard guys
the
were always...
Goths.
The elder goths were always these, like, 30-year-old guys. And you'd be like, what do you do when you're not Archimedes? Like, do you go home and what's happening? I used to
DJ in a goth club about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I couldn't imagine doing the same thing now, but I look at my old roommate still doing the exact same thing, only he's got more freaky looking. Dude, you're in your mid-30s.
Yeah.
Is this what you're going to do when you're hitting 50?
You're
is
like how
having
is
the
decision?
Mohawk? And
yeah. With his little, like, the little plastic study bracelets and the goth cape. You're like, I'm 30. Is this still cool? It's like, no, it's not. I don't get it. I don't know what's happening here. But
You should be past the awkward phase.
Oh, well, you know. Or you have to ask yourself why you need to be around people who are in that awkward phase still. Like, if you're 30, why are you still hanging out with these, like, 14-year-old elves? I just don't get it.
You hear that, people?
If you know why, then you should email me and tell me why you do it. I mean, I'm curious. You know, like, if that's you, if I'm describing you and you think I'm giving you the sort of short end of the stick, then let me know. You know, don't come to my house or anything, but email me. You know,
show up at a reading.
Don't show up at a reading like, hey, you! Yeah,
maybe a comic convention.
I know. Well, that's the thing. That's one of the joys of being a comic artist is that you get to go to these conventions and your people come to you. Like, stand in front of you at your table like, hello, I read this article you wrote 2 years ago on your blog. I have something to tell you about it. You're like, holy crap.
Someone pays attention.
I was like, geez, want a button? Hey, what's up, buddy? I'm like, holy cow. Yeah. The interface with your audience is really interesting.
Must be a different experience than the writing, the nonfiction crowds.
Totally. Well, in nonfiction, you go, or sort of writing in general, you go, you stand on a podium, you read, and then you leave. You don't have to talk to anybody. You just go. You leave, you know? In the comic world, you sit in a room for 4 hours and wait for people to come to you. You know, that's crazy talk. That's just nuts.
What do you think, Steve? Crazy talk?
No, it's just a crazy world.
Yeah. It's intense, too. It's just like... They're super fans. Like, I don't think that literature has super fans the way that comics have super fans. It's just making t-shirts with your face on it and stuff like that. You're like, whoa.
It's an odd world.
Yeah.
Let me tell you. What do you have in mind for follow-up?
Right
What's
now?
What's next in the comic-y world? Or even writing world?
Right now, I'm kind of... I have this couple of ideas for stories that involve kind of brother-sister type things. I have a brother, and he's moved very far away. He moved to Alaska recently, which has kind of made me think more about...
Golly gee.
I know he's an accountant
in Alaska.
He's a maverick. Hi, Fraser. So I have this now that I have sort of so much distance from him, and we have this kind of, you know, interesting... Like, we didn't like each other a lot as kids, and so thinking... about sibling rivalry and how you kind of grow out of that. So I've been thinking a lot about that kind of stuff lately. And then, as Steve pointed out when we were talking yesterday, I have this kind of circus obsession. So I really want to write about a circus or something to do with the circus. I'm hoping to do something with Steve so he will draw circus monkeys for me.
The computer
will draw some
control alt circus monkey.
So yeah, I mean, right now I'm fortunate to have a chance to just be writing, so that's what I'm doing right now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, any convention appearances or anything?
We were gonna go to Ape, and then that got
pooed.
So we're not doing it. Unfortunately, we're not going to Ape. Actually, Skim has been shortlisted for the Governor General's Award for Children's Literature. So,
Children's book, though.
Well.
But isn't it the first graphic novel to be nominated for any of the awards?
It's the first graphic novel to be nominated
wow.
for anything
so,
like
you know,
that,
Stepping
so.
Stones.
So, Stepping Stone. Stepping Stone. Yay! So, that's kind of like the sort of next thing, I guess, that's kind of happening in my life in terms of book stuff. Or things that happened in terms of book
stuff. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
And you
it's
won
crazy
an Ignatz.
And we won an Ignatz. We won a brick.
Yeah, who got the brick?
Julian got the brick. Julian has everything. Julian has, which is fine. Julian has the Doug Wright. I was there to receive. We got an honorary mention for the Doug Wright Awards. So I took the plaque home, put it in my study. And then when Julian came to Toronto, she took the plaque off my wall. With my permission. And so...
I'm taking this. Is that
yeah.
okay?
Well, no, because we've always sort of said that obviously this is a co-creation, so we're going to share the goods. When we won the Ignatz, it was a brick. It's an actual brick.
Yeah, no, I...
And we were in Maryland, and I was like, I can't take this home with me. Like, I can't put this in my suitcase. My suitcase weighs a ton anyway. I can't, like, pack a brick in there. So Julian was driving back to New York, so she took the brick with her.
I always wonder, like, how people bring the bricks home, because when I went to SPX, we went out through the Baltimore airport, which wasn't the wisest decision realized afterwards, because
yeah.
it's not very close to Bethesda, but the airport security, they're Nazis.
Yeah, they're crazy. It's funny because, when I came back to Canada from SPX, I was exhausted, and I had this crazy tube thing with this sign, like our vinyl sign, all rolled
yeah.
up in a tube. And the woman was like, "What do you got in there?" I was like, "It's a sign." "What was it for?" I was like, "Comic convention." She's like, "Did you spend money there?" And I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "What'd you buy?" And I was like, "Comic book." She was like, "Okay, fair enough." Like, you know, oh, that all makes sense. All right, you know, you're out. So, yeah, I don't know in terms of, I mean, we're going to try to do some other comic conventions, maybe they come to do one here in Vancouver and stuff like that.
And
we're also going to Lethbridge. If you're in Lethbridge, we're coming to Lethbridge.
Wow.
Lethbridge, yeah.
That'll be
exciting. Drink it in Lethbridge. If you want to come drink it with us in Lethbridge, we'll be there November 21st.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then you'll be at TCAF most likely.
Oh, yeah. We're going to do the whole TCAF thing.
I'm going to show up this time and
yeah?
get really drunk and
get,
have fun.
Make a mockery of yourself. I'm in TCAF! Stupid
Who
kid.
Wants to be in the radio?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And no one will talk to me.
I can't imagine why. I'll tell you it was a good interview. I'll be like, you know what, it's not so bad. He's a nice guy. You should do it. And then
okay.
I'll send Steve to be a bouncer yeah. to make sure everyone's safe.
It's okay, I'll
Steve?
Send protection.
Yeah.
Steve is an awesome bouncer. I've seen him do it.
I would imagine.
Just that one time, you know, I threw him out of our good buddy out of our room.
Yeah, he knows who he is, too. And he was drunk and obnoxious and threw a beer bottle at a table. And
whoa.
Steve was like,
yeah,
bam, you're out of here. And it was magic.
Good times down in Seattle. Yeah.
At La Hacienda.
La Hacienda Motor Lodge or something like that.
I'm still surprised none of us got bed bugs.
Wow.
It's not a classy joint.
What are you talking about? Come on.
You're like,
see, they even have security outside certain rooms.
Yeah, they're called pimps.
Sure.
And the limo?
Pimpin.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Steve, thank you as well.
Yes, I'm still here.
You're
there
still
you go.
Here? Steve hasn't suddenly disappeared. Well,
no.
We were just talking. And look forward to anything possible coming up.
Excellent.
Okay,
I'll let you know.